You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. An amazing, amazing story here. One of the top oil industry officials has threatened the president of the United States politically. The president of the American Petroleum Institute, Jack Girard, said that if Obama didn't approve the XL pipeline quickly, he would face, quote, huge political consequences. We have reached the point in this country where an industry is threatening a sitting president with, you know, we're going to take you out politically. Tell me Citizens United hasn't gone on steroids and gone insane. But there's a larger issue here, too, and that is, you know, the XL pipeline, the oil thing. I read this story recently that suggested that the United States has become, here we are, the Associated Press. For the first time, the top export of the United States, the world's biggest gas guzzler, is, wait for it, fuel. We export a lot of wood products. We export, you know, we're basically a third world nation now. We don't export so many finished goods, but we export a lot of raw materials, a lot of, you know, mining products and coal and things like that. Now our number one export is gas and diesel fuel, refined oil. And, of course, our number one import is oil. So what is going on? Tyler Slocum is the director of Public Citizens Energy Program and an expert on this stuff. And citizen.org, of course, the website. Tyler, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here.
Great to have you with us. First of all, in my setup for all this, was basically what everything I said accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, what's going on here is that since 2008 and the economic collapse, domestic demand for gasoline has been pretty anemic. It's been pretty flat. At the same time, oil production here in the United States has been at record highs. We're producing more oil today under the Obama administration than we did at any point during the Bush administration.
Is that because of increased offshore drilling or because of fracking?
It's a combination of all.
Finding new oil?
Offshore and a lot of unconventional oil and sustained high prices for crude.
Yeah.
You have to remember, the United States is the third largest crude oil producing nation in the world. Only the Saudis and the Russians produce more than we do. So the combination of record high oil production with flat domestic gasoline consumption has led many refiners to look to export refined products, and they do that to help boost refining profits.
So,
because
wait a minute.
If gasoline demand is really flat here in the United States, and you're only selling in the United States, you're not going to make a whole lot of money.
And the price should go down. Gas, what's the price of gas right now on average around the United States?
You know, I haven't looked. It's around $3.50 or so a
okay,
gallon.
So
it's pretty high.
Right, so if gasoline is selling for $3.50 a gallon on average in the United States right now, and or more or less, the laws of supply and demand actually worked, and you would think, at least within a domestic marketplace, you would think that if there's an excess supply and a diminished demand, that the price would drop. And the price hasn't dropped. I'm curious, when these refiners export that gasoline, I'm guessing they're not getting $3.50 a gallon for it.
Right. They're selling into a pretty competitive global marketplace. And so by doing so, they're able to prop up domestic gasoline prices here in the United States.
Right. So they're doing this not to increase their profits through export. I mean, they may be exporting at cost or at a small profit, but by exporting it, they're keeping it off the U.S. market, thus maintaining low levels of supply relative to demand so they can maintain high prices.
Absolutely. And what's really interesting is that we have federal regulations that make it very difficult to export crude oil that's produced here in the United States. You have to get an export license from the U.S. Department of Commerce, and it's difficult to obtain.
Right.
There are no such regulations on exporting refined products like gasoline and diesel. So, and if you look at the details, you know, a lot of people are talking about this Keystone pipeline that would take Canadian tar sands crude oil from Alberta, Canada, and bring it down to the United States. Well, we're already processing about 1 million barrels of Canadian tar sands oil every day in the Midwest. Almost all of it is refined in Ohio, Illinois, Indiana.
Are they bringing it by, bringing in by truck?
No. There's a pipeline that already serves that.
Oh, really?
What the Keystone Pipeline does is it expands the existing pipeline system to divert the oil away from the Midwestern refineries and bring it down to the Gulf Coast refineries.
Where can they export it?
Do you think 90% of all the fuel exports occur in the Gulf Coast refinery section? The Keystone Pipeline is really about boosting the profits of domestic refiners by adding to this already record export gasoline market. It's about importing Canadian crude to export the gasoline that we process.
And what companies own most of the refining industry in the Gulf Coast, in Texas?
Oh, it's ExxonMobil, it's Shell, it's Chevron Texaco, it's ConocoPhillips, it's Valero, it's all the big majors.
What about the Koch brothers?
They're not a major refiner, actually.
Oh, that's interesting.
They own some pipelines, but the refining business is really dominated by the big majors.
Okay.
And now with the American Petroleum Institute launching this new campaign, you know, saying we need the Keystone Pipeline, we need to drill for more oil in the United States because apparently being the third largest producer of crude oil isn't enough. And they're talking about refining more here. It's all about boosting the profits of these big oil companies to turn the United States into even a bigger export market.
And if my recollection is correct, that list that you gave of oil companies, at least half of those companies are not even American companies.
Right. I mean, these are big multinationals. And even for a company like ExxonMobil, it's a multinational. This
right.
is a company that has its headquarters in the United States, but they do business. They don't pledge allegiance to the United States every day. They
right.
pledge allegiance to wherever they can make the most money. That's what a multinational does.
Yeah. And finally, Tyler, here we are importing crude oil, exporting refined oil, in the process of transforming crude oil into gasoline and diesel fuel that we can then export to presumably what, Mexico? Is that
actually it's South America, it's Europe, and some parts of Asia.
Amazing.
But South America is definitely a big destination market.
Okay. So in the process of transforming that crude oil into these refined oil products, gasoline and things that we're exporting to South and Central America and to Europe, isn't there produced an enormous amount of toxic material that gets poured into the air and water that causes cancer downstream? I've heard of these cancer alleys.
Right. Cancer Alley Cancer Alley extends from the Texas Gulf refining coast into Louisiana. And that's because that's where the bulk of U.S. refineries are located. It's a dirty, messy business.
Okay. So you and I are, through our tax dollars, principally through Medicare, we're paying, because those Cancer Alley areas are typically minority and poor.
Absolutely.
We are paying for the health care costs associated with this refinery business. The oil companies are not paying a penny of that cost. And we're also, for all the imported oil that is coming into this country, being refined and then shipped to Mexico, we're paying for the military that protects those shipping lines. And the oil companies are not paying a penny of that. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's incredible. What a scam.
We're not getting our money's worth on this. It would make a lot more sense to figure out how we can give American families more tools to help them avoid these high gas prices and give them cleaner alternatives.
Yeah, like let's build out a solar infrastructure and start getting electric cars going, for example, or mass transportation.
Absolutely.
Mass transit. Tyler Slocum, with the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. You can read about it at citizen.org. Thank you, Tyler.
It's my pleasure.
Or Tyson, I'm sorry. Great talking with you, Tyson.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We will be back in just a moment. 15 minutes past the hour. What kind of scam? And now this, you've got an industry threatening the president? What?
Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same grain. From the banks of the river to the banks.
Now, this is pretty amazing. I mean, this is extraordinary. A decade ago, 10 years ago, gasoline wasn't even among our top 25 exports. Now it's our number one export. And at the same time, the oil industry, which is making huge money off this and making huge money off us and keeping the price of gasoline artificially high in the United States by exporting all the surplus that they're refining. They're saying we need even more raw material so we can refine more stuff and cause more cancer in the United States. And let's import more of this stuff so that, you know, as long as the military will make sure that we get that oil from the Persian Gulf for free. I mean, not for free, but not have to pay the cost to the military. Keep in mind, ExxonMobil basically didn't pay any federal income taxes the last couple of years. They're just rolling along, having a good old time. This is really quite extraordinary. We are exporting more gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel than any other single export product. Meanwhile, the whole Republican mantra is, No regulations, right? We need to do away with job-killing regulations. And the principal regulation I think that they're worried about, because you hear all this hysteria about the EPA, is the regulation that says if you're going to run a refinery, there are limits on how much poison you can throw into the air. Now, obviously, they're letting too much poison go into the air because we've got these cancer alleys. But that said, if the Republicans had, I shouldn't even say Republican. This is not partisan. There are Democrats who are saying this too. If the conservatives, the Republicans and the conservative Dems, had their way, if the politicians who have become captives of the oil industry had their way, then there'd be even more poison going into our air and even more raw material coming into the United States and more finished oil. Isn't that incredible when you think about it? You walk into a store and you look around for something made in America, you can't find anything, and you discover that, we're still exporting things. What are we exporting? Gasoline. What? Well, other countries don't want to refine it. It's a dirty, stinky business. So what if we did cut back on those regulations? Well, obviously, it's going to increase the profitability of the giant oil companies, and it's going to increase the number of cases of cancer that we have in the United States. But beyond that, what's it going to do to the economy and to the job market? Michael Conathan, blogging over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, the headline, I think, says it all. Job-killing EPA regulations for Chesapeake Bay will create 35 times as many jobs as the Keystone XL pipeline. Job killing, of course, in quotes. In other words, the regulations that are being proposed for the Chesapeake Bay to clean it up will create 35 times more jobs than the XL pipeline. Why? Because if you say you got to clean something up, then they got to hire somebody to clean it up. Pretty simple. A new report released today by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation highlights the job creation numbers expected to come from achieving new pollution goals set by the EPA's total maximum daily load restrictions. Finalized in December 2010, these rules require a 25% reduction of pollution flowing into the Chesapeake Bay by the year 2025. Upgrades at sewage treatment facilities, power plant smokestack scrubbers, management of agricultural runoff and livestock waste management. Basically clean up the Chesapeake Bay. Now, this doesn't specifically have to do with the oil industry, but it, in a very real way, I'd say it's absolutely meta to it. It's that what they're saying basically is that if we clean up the mess in the Chesapeake Bay, and if we start regulating the waste that is being produced by factory farms and by refineries and by power plants and sewage treatment facilities, and we set tighter standards, just cut their emissions by a quarter and do it in the next, what is this, 2012, by 2025, the next 13 years. That's going to create 35 times more jobs than the Keystone XL pipeline. And we already have pipelines bringing this oil from Canada to refineries in Michigan, Illinois, and Indiana, as Tyson Slocum just pointed out to us. This is just, it's mind-boggling to me. The clock is already ticking, they write, on a newly minted 60-day congressional mandate for the president to issue a decision on the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Where are we going to go with this? Sometimes I look at these things and I wonder how is it that our news media doesn't point these things out? How can this be so invisible to the average American? How is that even possible? How is it possible, for example, that the state of Virginia now officially has the best legislature money can buy? That, you know, 50 pieces of legislation that are carbon copies of laws passed by, you know, put together by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers funded, you know, let's write laws that are friendly to business and hostile to unions. And the taxpayers of Virginia paid more than $230,000. This is according to a new report from the advocacy group Progress Now. $230,000 been paid to fly mostly Republican lawmakers to these various ALEC functions. It's mind-boggling. By the way, did you see that the president says that he's going to cut the... He's having a meeting today at the Pentagon. That over the next decade, they're going to cut $1 trillion out of defense spending? This is... I think this is moving in the right direction. Tightening things up, making things more effective. Keep in mind, defense spending has tripled since 1998. Tripled. And, you know, we were pretty tough in 1998. So, a lot of stuff in the news, a lot of very interesting things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the New York Times has finally discovered that social mobility in the United States ain't happening. I'll tell you about that after the break. It's Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman Program. However, it does not lead to stiff thinking. But don't tell Rush Limbaugh. He'll want some. Did you know that in 1991, when Mitt Romney was running Bain Financial, helping build the company was about to go under, and he got a $10 million bailout from the federal government to keep them from collapsing? Very interesting. It's the top story at Daily Kos today. You might want to check it out if you have an internet connection. Mitt Romney, bailout queen, is out there condemning crony capitalism. Mind-boggling. But as to the EPA, here we are. Let me just share with you some of the Republican perspectives on regulation in the EPA, and I'll pick up some of your phone calls. But here, this is Herman Cain, first of all. Clip 15, Jacob.
If I were forced to eliminate a department, I would start with the EPA and start all over.
There you go. So that's Herman Cain saying he's going to, you know, well, what does the EPA do? It keeps the air clean, right? Oh, we can't have that. Here's clip 16, Lamar Alexander, the Republican from Tennessee.
So the only issue is whether an unelected group of bureaucrats or the United States Congress should decide what to do about carbon.
Yeah. Do we leave it up to the scientists or do we leave it to the politicians who are paid off by the oil companies? Well, Senator Kit Bond, the Republican from Missouri, had some thoughts on this.
Families and workers in my state, like everybody else, don't want to see the lost jobs, the higher energy costs that EPA's big government takeover of carbon regulations would bring.
Right. We can't protect people from carbon and the planet, for that matter. I mean, keep in mind, we're talking global warming here. We can't do that because that's going to lose jobs. You know, just consider the reverse logic of this. You tell a refiner that you can't release as much fill in the blank, right, whether it's benzene or carbon, into the air, and so you got to figure out a way to scrub it out. Then that refiner is going to actually have to hire a company that has designers who can develop a product, manufacture the product, install the product, maintain the product. Sounds to me like that's jobs. That regulation creates jobs. But not according to Saxby Chambliss, the Republican from Georgia. Here's Senator Chambliss.
What the overreach by EPA is going to do is to raise that cost of energy to every farmer and rancher in America, in a very, very negative way.
Yeah, well, you know, arguably you could say, yeah, if they have to spend a little bit more money producing this stuff in ways that don't kill people downstream, or using domestic sources that you know we don't have to bring in from the Middle East, that might raise the cost of energy slightly, but it's going to reduce the cost of Medicare. In net, as Americans, we're all going to pay less. Our environment is going to be cleaner. We're going to have fewer natural disasters because of less global warming. But, you know, the oil industry may not make as much money. Here's George Voinovich, the Republican from Ohio, on this topic.
I think for the EPA to go forward with this regulation would be a universal surrender of our economy in terms of our competition in that global marketplace.
Right. How dare we, how dare we regulate carbon dioxide? Mike Enzi, the Republican from Wyoming, we'll wrap this up with him.
Stopping this regulation the way that Senator Murkowski has proposed is the way to make sure that the American people are protected and the jobs are protected and agencies realize they can't overreach.
Yeah, that's right. These agencies shouldn't overreach. We shouldn't let the scientists that we hired to run the science agencies to keep us safe overreach and regulate things that might make the oil industry a little bit less profitable. By the way, they're maintaining their profits by exporting gasoline and oil. I just find the whole thing just mind-boggling. Paul in Irvine. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm taking a speakerphone. Can you hear me okay?
No, I don't. It sounds like you're on a speakerphone.
Oh, there you go. Are you okay? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's about the same, but go ahead. Let's just do this.
All right. Hey, Tom, sorry. I was just thinking that the oil companies are the ones making the biggest profit.
But Paul, I'm really sorry. You're going to have to call it. Now you're breaking up. It's just breaking up badly. You're going to have to call back another time. Kelly in Berkeley. Hey, Kelly, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I was just blown away by this information about the oil from your first guest today, and I had an idea. You know, the Occupy movement is really not getting out their message, and I think we need to think strategically. And my idea is that we organize and we not stop business, not stop the flow, but occupiers across the country, all on the same day, just have a sign up giving out, you know, just little clips of this information on the oil companies.
Right.
And that we start organizing in that way.
You mean like occupy the gas stations and everybody hold up a sign that says the number one export of the United States right now is gasoline and the oil companies are doing this to keep their profits high, for example. Or why do we need the pipeline when our number one export is gasoline?
Right, and not to stop people from going in and buying their gas.
Right.
I think we need to be very careful.
No, interfering with commerce, over the short term might be an arguable tactic, but B, according to the Patriot Act, makes you a terrorist. I would never want to suggest anybody become a terrorist. Kelly, excellent point. Thank you very much. Occupy the gas stations. Richard in England calling, listening on the web. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hi, I'm actually German. Mm-hmm. I'm living in England, and I've got the weirdest German accent you've ever heard.
Yeah,
but the one thing that
sounds like
really,
a Scottish German accent
really annoys me. Pardon?
It sounds like a Scottish German accent.
Ja, ich kann ja auch Deutsch reden, also das ist kein Problem.
Yeah,
but the one thing that really annoys me is called Obamacare, and what was there previously?
Nothing.
It was corporate-sponsored murder. If you had a pre-existing condition, sorry, you can't get insurance, you die.
Yes. I think the right-wingers started calling it Obamacare here in the United States as a way of putting it down because they thought that Obama was unpopular. I call it Obamacare. It's actually called the Affordable Care Act. I call it Obamacare, and increasingly people in the Obama administration are calling it Obamacare because they want him to own it.
I actually know who the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is. That is Justice Roberts.
Yeah.
So I do know a bit about the U.S.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when I was in my 20s, I had my discs implode into my spine.
Ouch.
I was studying I didn't have any money. We weren't rich. I am middle class, but we weren't rich.
Yeah.
I was taken in the hospital. I had my spine operated on. I was out 2 weeks later. And I was a productive member of society.
This was,
I was not in
Germany or in the UK?
Yes, this was in Germany.
In Germany, okay. Yeah. And you didn't have to pay a medical bill.
I was not destroyed for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't told, oh, sorry, you've got a pre-existing condition.
Yeah.
Or, we have to, the insurance decided to do rescission on me.
Yep. You've used the British healthcare system. You've used the German healthcare system. They work for you, and you're you think that the United States, that Obamacare is a step in the right direction.
I'm 52 years old now,
sir.
This is when it happened to me. This was 26, 27 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I've helped so many people since I got my free medical treatment.
Yes.
And I've paid so many taxes. I have never paid less than 50% taxes in my life.
Yeah. And had you lived in the United States and had you had to and not had health insurance when your spine was damaged, you could have run up hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills that now...
No, I'd be dead.
Yeah, you'd be dead. Yeah, actually, probably if you were uninsured. Or if you could find a hospital and a doctor who would operate on you and put it on the credit card, you could be so far in debt that even now at the age of 52, you would still be paying off the bills. Richard, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to us from the UK. Vi in Donovan, Missouri. Hey, Vi, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. I'm glad to talk to you today. I'm mostly concerned about ALEC, and I'm wondering if our Attorney General can repeal the voter suppression laws that so many of these states have enacted vis-a-vis the ALEC.
Yeah, well, first of all, with regard to those laws coming from ALEC, to the best of my knowledge, there are no laws, either state or federal, that say that a legislator cannot introduce a law written by a lobbyist or by, you know, a front group from the Koch brothers or whatever. So that's not a basis to do it. However, a couple of weeks ago, the Attorney General of the United States did give a speech in which he said that he was very concerned that these voter suppression laws were running afoul of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, because they were disproportionately hitting minorities. And if they decide, and they've got, you know, between now and November to do so, if they decide to go after these states and say, you know, these voter suppression laws that are being put into place in Republican states, Republicans, by the way, who didn't require a photo ID for the Iowa primary, for the Iowa caucuses, and who didn't require advance registration for the Iowa caucuses, and, you know, but these, and so therefore didn't have voter suppression laws. But these voter suppression laws that are being put into place, if he determines, and he can build a good legal case, that they are in violation of the Civil Rights Act, then perhaps he can put them on hold, and I think that that's his goal. We'll have to keep an eye on it, Vi. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, a mailbag alert, and bit more of the Rick Snyder, what he's up to in Michigan. I got to tell you about this too. This is amazing. $250,000. It's Talk Media for the Sane Among Us.
You know,
welcome back.
It's nice when the postman has a letter in a sack for you.
Oh, that music means we have a mailbag alert. Here it is. This one of the people posted, I believe, over on our message board. A request for correction. I remember it. Earlier in the week, I had made a comment about the world wasn't going to end and the Mayans aren't around. In fact, I think it was in some, you know, just a conversation I was having with Victoria Jones. And so this fellow writes in and says, the Mayans are still here, Tom. I am Mayan. Further, we are members of a group of Mayan scientists. You stated Mayans are no longer here. This is incorrect. We request a correction. The Mayans are still here, and that there are Mayan American scientists, too. The Maya never stated the end of the world. The Maya hieroglyphs and oral history predicted the arrival of asteroid 2005 YU-55 that missed the Earth November 8th, 2011. It missed because it was closer to the orbit of the moon. Asteroid YU-55 will arrive in Earth's orbit on April 13th, 2036. The Mayans, he says, left the markers. Mayan stellae relief to warn 24 years. And what looks like a rocket ship is indeed the plan to rocket to asteroid YU-55 to harpoon the asteroid, then move it out and into another trajectory. Thus, we have 24 years to harpoon asteroid YU-55 and move it from its trajectory toward Earth's orbit, because once it enters Earth's orbit, we are doomed. Signed, Mayan American scientist. Okay, I stand corrected. Not sure the world's going to end with the asteroid, but I stand corrected that the Mayan are gone. I remember this is years ago, we were doing our annual Columbus Day show, and I talked about how the Columbus had basically killed off all the Taino Native Americans in what we now call Haiti and the Dominican Republic. In fact, they were committing suicide. The oppression of the Spaniards was so horrible. And I said, you know, they're gone. Their gene pool is gone. That's what I thought at the time. And somebody called in from Florida and said, hey, I'm Taino, and there's a lot of us here. We just fled the island. or at least some of our ancestors did. So you learn things as you go along. I have the smartest listeners on Earth, and apparently a few Mayans among them. Tony in Phoenix. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, hello, Tom. Great show as always.
Thank you.
Hey, I recently viewed Gasland and was shocked about how many fracking wells have been drilled on BLM land.
Yeah.
My question is there any initiative to repeal Cheney's backroom deal to lease this land?
You know, I don't think that most Americans even know about Cheney's backroom deal. There were actually two of them. One of them was making that the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, in other words, our federal lands, making federal lands available to frackers. But I think the even more important one was the EPA was holding up, I believe it was the EPA, it was whatever agency regulates fracking, you know, oil drilling. It might have been the Minerals and Mine Services, but whichever federal agency it was, they were holding up approval of fracking because they were concerned that the chemicals waste slurry that's pumped down into the earth to crack up the earth, that there are enormous amounts of chemical waste that are produced in the refining process. And it used to be that you had to pay very, very high prices to dispose of this stuff in, like, super high-temperature incinerators so that it didn't get in. You know, these are poisons, right, that don't have industrial application. Benzene, hexane, things like that. To some extent, they have industrial application, but less and less and less because we've discovered how toxic and how carcinogenic they are. And so the concern was that these companies had figured out that instead of paying $1,000 a pound to dispose of toxic waste, they could simply pump it into the ground and call it fracking lubricant. And so the agency was saying, you've got to tell us what's in your fracking liquid. And to this day, we don't know what's in that fracking liquid because the fracking companies were saying it's proprietary. And the concern of many of us was it wasn't proprietary because it was like some secret formula like Colonel Sanders' Kentucky Fried Chicken. It was proprietary because they didn't want you to know that it was toxic waste that they were injecting into the earth and that they were doing it as a way of getting rid of it because that was cheaper than using the old, you know, old-fashioned disposal methods. And Cheney, in the last months of the Bush presidency, nullified that rule or regulation or got around it somehow. We did it. We did a whole, you know, day on the air about it, got on one of the experts, and I don't have the details at my fingertips, but it was Dick Cheney who did that out of the vice president's office, which is pretty much unheard of. And, you know, basically using the executive office to issue the equivalent of an executive order to tell an agency to do something. Dick Cheney, who, by the way, claimed that he wasn't part of the executive branch, that he was part of the legislative branch, because the vice president is the president of the Senate, but that's a whole other thing. So, yeah.
The other disturbing thing that on Gasland, the documentary, was not only are they pumping back into the earth, they're aerating it to get rid of the waste.
Yeah, evaporating
the atmosphere, which is, you know, crazy. But
yeah, and it's getting into there are several cities now that have asked the fracking companies to stop dumping their liquids into storm drains because it's overwhelming their water pollution systems. They can't handle it. They can't filter it out. These high fractions of petroleum products. So clearly, it's the waste material from refineries that they're using, and then a lot of wastewater plants dump into rivers that downstream are water sources for other cities, and And so it's creating some significant problems. And you're right, Gasland is a great movie. And Josh Fox, is that his name, Jacob? I'm pretty sure it is. Josh Fox, who did Gasland, has been on this program a number of times. So great. Thank you very much, Tony. Good point. Carol in Valencia. Hey, Carol, what's up? Carol? No Carol. Well, that's interesting. I wonder if we're having phone problems today. That's Cliff in Santa Clarita, California. Hey, Cliff, we've got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm just going to play on that Mayan thing you're talking about when you suggested the end of the world.
Well, I didn't. He did.
That, no, I know. But the calendar ending on Winter Solstice Day 2012, it's up for speculation and interpretation at this point.
Sure.
And there's lots of different theories as to what's going to come. You know, Hollywood already jumped on this with their doomsday, end of the world, apocalyptic disaster scenario. So I dismissed that one immediately. Yeah, that's who they are. But I listen to a late night esoteric, paranormal, metaphysical radio show, and the message I'm getting is that we're already going through this transformational change on our planet. We're moving into the age of Aquarius,
yes.
And this global awakening is supposedly happening, and it may be that's what's happening around the world.
Cliff, I would not discount that at all. And in Hinduism, it's called yugas, that we're moving into another yuga. But I don't know. Thank you, Cliff.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, what an amazing day. In the news business, as it were, we just discovered in 1991. How did we not know this before? 1991, Mitt Romney got a $10 million bailout from the federal government to keep alive Bain Financial, his company. The guy who's running around talking about how bailouts are a terrible thing. Anyhow, Dr. Robert Jeffress is with us. He's the senior pastor of the 11,000-member First Baptist Church of Dallas, Texas, author of the new book, Twilight's Last Gleaming, his website, firstdallas.org. And I first met Dr. Jeffress, and I'm sorry I didn't remember this last night when you were on television with me, sir. You and I were both on the Bill Maher show at the same time.
Yes, that's exactly right, a few months ago.
Yes, and I remember a very, very nice conversation in the little reception, the cocktail reception they have after the show,
yes.
Meeting your wife and the other people along with you. You are somewhat notorious, I suppose, probably not a word you'd use to describe, but certainly Mitt Romney would, for identifying Mitt Romney as a cult follower because he's a Mormon. And when you look at the stats, the evangelical vote in Iowa, Rick Santorum picked up 53% of that vote. Ron Paul got 14%. Romney only got 8% of the evangelical vote. I'm curious your thought as a well-known Baptist minister who has publicly endorsed Rick Perry, and Rick Perry has accepted that endorsement, and you have and has not repudiated you, even though Mitt Romney has asked him to. What your thoughts are on Mitt Romney going forward, and would you vote for a cult leader in a man who is in your mind?
Yeah,
a cult
and
leader?
Of course, there's a context to all of that. I was asked after I introduced Perry, you know, what I thought about Mormonism, and I said, look, Mormons are good, moral people, but they're not Christians. Mormonism is not a part of historic Christianity. It is a cult, and I went on to explain it's a theological cult. But, you know, I think the problem that evangelicals have with Mitt Romney is not limited to the Mormon problem. In fact, I'm not even sure the majority of evangelicals have a problem with the Mormon issue, but I think enough have a problem with it that it could be a real problem if Mitt Romney is the nominee. Look, I think you can win the Republican nomination without evangelical support. I don't think you can win the White House. And John McCain found that out. You know, 30 million evangelicals sat at home in 2008. Barack Obama won by 10 million votes. So I do think...
And you could argue that Jimmy Carter in part won because of the evangelical vote, because this was back before the evangelical vote had been so highly partisanized, shall we say. And Carter was arguably the first American president to come out and declare himself a born-again Christian.
That's right.
But you know, this idea that Mormonism is a cult, you say that Mormonism is a cult because they claim to be a recently revealed religion, that Joseph Smith found the tablets of gold in the early 1800s and transcribed them, and that became the Book of Mormon, and this is a revelation from God, and that the Christian world only acknowledges the revelation from God of the Bible. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's one of the three reasons we call it a theological cult.
So,
as a human leader versus a divine leader, Joseph Smith versus Jesus Christ. Secondly, like you said, a different book of revelation. And then thirdly, it has a set of doctrines that are antithetical to historic Orthodox Christianity.
Okay, well, then why, by those definitions, first of all, you know, I think you'd have to acknowledge that many Catholics would say that you're not a Christian because you're a Baptist. Okay, so there's all these debates within Christianity, and the Book of Mormon explicitly endorses Jesus. I mean, you know, it's not an anti-Jesus book. But why isn't Christianity itself a cult? Here, Christianity, you've got a book that was written by people, right? And that was selected over a 300 or 400 year period by a whole bunch of different councils of Nicaea and everything else, up until the Second Council of Constantinople in what was it, 366 was it, or what? I don't remember my Christian history all that well, but it was some hundreds of years after Jesus was dead. And the original church that Jesus founded with his 12 disciples, the Jerusalem church, basically died out. You know, there are some Orthodox religions, the Greek, not the Greek, the Egyptian Orthodox, claim that they're from that lineage.
Hold it. It didn't die out. That church.
It was replaced by the Pauline church.
Within 200 years, toppled the entire Roman Empire.
No, that was the Pauline church. That was the church that was created by Paul, who was not one of Jesus' disciples.
Oh, yes, he was.
He never met Jesus in the flesh.
He met him on the road to Damascus.
Jesus had been crucified by that point.
And he had been resurrected and ascended into heaven and appeared to Paul.
Well, that's all assuming that.
Here's what it comes to.
You know, I don't so much want to argue Christianity with you, because, you know, here I am. I call myself a Christian.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that if your criteria of a cult is that they've got a human leader, or spokesperson, shall we say. The letters of Paul, I think, are not that different or for that matter, the revelation of Paul certainly is not that different from, and that was long after Jesus was crucified.
Well, but Orthodox Christians would say that is a part of the Bible, and that was a revelation from God. So if secularists want to call us a cult, I guess you could say that, you know. So,
okay.
Yeah,
all right. Then That's interesting that you would say that, because I think,
I mean, our friend Bill Maher would say all religion is based on crazy ideas and you're all cultists.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I wouldn't say that, and that I'm not all that worried about being a member of a cult.
But there is a huge difference between Mormonism and historic Christianity, which Mormons acknowledge. They said the whole church was apostate since the time of the apostles until Joseph Smith discovered the tablets. So they've not been a part of historic Christianity by their own admission.
So have you, so Mitt Romney is a Mormon. He's
and your original question, Tom, was would I vote for him?
Right. That's where I was going to get.
Yeah. And I said on Fox the other day, I said, look, in November, those of us who are evangelical Christians may have to hold our nose when we vote and choose between the lesser of two evils. But it's not November yet, and we still have plenty of shopping days left. And in my book, Twilight's Last Gleaming, I say to Christians, you know, we ought to go ahead and look for the most conservative, competent, consistently conservative Christian with character. And then if we have two choices come November, then we'd make the choice of the lesser of two evils.
Shouldn't, there's a large movement within the Christian church. I think Chris Hedges is probably one of the best representatives of this, who, you know, was a, you know, went through seminary and openly calls himself a Christian. Very thoughtful guy. And I don't know if you're familiar with his writings. But there is a substantial movement within the various Christian denominations to say, you know, no, Matthew 25 is our lodestar, or our star, you know, lone star, whatever the word is. And the idea that we should be caring for the hungry, or feeding the hungry and caring for the poor and housing the homeless, that's the really important stuff. That was Jesus' message, not pick on the gays or make sure everybody has a gun. Shouldn't Christians be voting based on policy rather than on religion, on policies that are consistent with Matthew 25, for example?
Well, I think it ought to be. In fact, in my book, which you were kind enough to mention, Twilight's Last Gleaming, I talk about four questions we ought to ask before we vote about any candidate. And one of those questions is, does the candidate's policies align with the Bible? And look, you can take issues like cap and trade, climate control, taxation, universal health care, and quite frankly, I could argue either side of any of those issues and use the Bible to argue both sides. The Bible isn't real clear.
But you can't use the Bible to argue, but you can't argue both sides of should we feed the hungry.
That's what I'm getting to.
Okay.
I'm getting to, and I agree with you. Yes, the Bible talks about caring for the poor. Yes, it talks about the sanctity of marriage and the importance of protecting life both outside of the womb and inside the womb.
Although back then, marriage meant 700 wives.
All three of them are important.
Okay. All right. Dr. Robert Jeffress, thank you very much for being on the program. Good talking with you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Senior pastor of the 11,000 member First Baptist Church of Dallas, firstdallas.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So that's interesting. Is Mitt Romney a cultist, and is that going to hurt him in the election, if assuming he is the Republican nominee, which I still think is a safe assumption?
Wade in the water. Wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water.
Welcome back to your media support group for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you. Back in 2009, CNN picked out their heroes of the year, and one of them was a guy by the name of Doc Hendley. And he is the founder and president of Water to Wine. Watertowine.org is the website. And no, it's not. I don't think it's biblical, is it, Doc?
Well, it does have. I'm actually the son of a preacher man, and so our organization name is actually the flip of what Christ did. Wine to water.
Yeah.
And
did water to wine, actually, for the wedding.
Yeah. So exactly. So for
us, so you're wine to water. I'm sorry. Did I say water to wine?
Yeah.
I got it backwards. It's winetowater.org. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a problem. It's actually perfect because I mean, Christ obviously performed that miracle because that's what the need was at the time. There was a wedding. It was very frowned upon to run out of wine, and so he did what he had to do, and they had water there.
Or at least that was the story. So what are you doing? You're not an engineer. You don't have a degree in public policy, but you are providing people all over the planet with drinkable water. How do you do this? What are you doing?
Well, one of our biggest things is sustainability. So it was really when I was living in Darfur, Sudan, one of the biggest things that I saw was that there were wells all over the East African desert that were in non-working order. And so I'm like, well, why is that? These organizations go in and they put a brand new well in, and then all of a sudden it'll break in 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then the people go back to walking hours to get water.
Right.
So we began fixing those wells and then also training and teaching locals throughout the desert and giving them the tools and resources necessary to fix their own wells. So after I left Darfur, we're now in 12 different countries around the world. We use locals on the ground in every single country, whether we're drilling wells or providing water filters or whatever we're doing. The whole point is that we teach the locals on the ground how to access their own clean drinking water, whether it's through a well or a filter or whatever, and then have them do the work using their local materials that are available to them.
Hmm. And what motivated you to start this? When did you start? And how old were you when you started this thing?
I was 20. Gosh, let me see. About 24 years old. I was bartending and playing music around Raleigh, North Carolina. I was getting ready to get a degree at North Carolina State University, and I woke up middle of the night one night in my bed with the phrase "wine to water" in my head. And I'm like, obviously, from my old man, I heard it the other way around. I'm like, well, why is this stuck in my head? And so I wrote it down. I'm a little bit of a musician, so I was thinking maybe this would be a cool song. And I wrote it down, and I stared at it for a while, and I'm like, I think it's more than that. And so I began to research water because I knew plenty about wine, being a bartender.
Yeah.
I began to research water that night, and I found out how bad the water crisis was.
More than half of the 7 billion humans on Earth right now do not have access to reliable water.
Yeah, it was shocking when I started looking at the figures. Yeah.
In fact, I believe it's something
shocking is that nobody knows about it.
Yes, either 5 or 6 billion out of the 7 billion people on Earth don't have reliable access to water.
Yeah, to both water and sanitation is absolutely huge, huge need. And so I got really passionate because I'm like, not only is it such a huge problem, but there's so many people here in the States that don't know about it. So I wanted to do something about it and also try to tell people about this.
So crisis. What country is wine2water.org operating in? What countries?
So right now we started in Sudan, then we moved to Ethiopia, then Uganda, South Africa, India, Sri Lanka, Cambodia, Peru, Ecuador, Haiti, and I'm leaving one out, I think, but I think I've lost it off the top of my head.
Wow.
So we're very much global organization right now.
That is great. I have done relief work in all but two of those countries, and
oh,
I can
wow.
tell you the need is substantial. The organization that I work with is Salem International, saleminternational.org. Uh-huh. But we don't do water stuff. We do other things. But Wine to Water, and is this a book now?
What's that now?
Is this a book? Did you write a book?
My book is released. Today is the big day, and that was something exciting for us because it was finally a platform where, because there are so many people that don't know about the water crisis, we're hoping that the book will, in a fun, kind of exciting way, be able to also tell people just about how bad this water crisis really is.
Right. So the book is called Wine to Water. The website is wine2water.org. Doc Hendley, congratulations on doing great work.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for being on our program today. Great to have you on. Good talking with you. This is a great start. Marie in Salt Lake, Utah. Hey, Marie, what's on your mind today?
First, I thank the Lord for you every day. You're amazing.
Well, thank you.
And I want to clarify some things about the cover up, the religious right facade. I am a member of the LDS Church.
Mm-hmm. A Mormon.
We're taught that the church doesn't endorse one party or another.
Yep.
But in fact, everybody follows along like blind.
Yeah, like baby ducks behind mama duck or whatever.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And they follow the Republican Party, it seems. Although Harry Reid is a Mormon, you know?
Well, and I made the mistake of voting for one of those Republicans one time.
Mm-hmm.
That was Reagan, and I've regretted it ever since. But it doesn't make any difference because I live in Utah, and they will never vote for anybody but Republicans.
Yeah. So what do you think about the fundamentalist perspective that your religion is a cult?
It's not a cult if you study it and take your individual responsibility.
Yeah. I think that we need to come up with a definition of cult because the LDS is actually the fastest growing church, I think, in the world, maybe just in the United States, but it's certainly the fastest growing church in the United States. And, you know, does that mean, could a cult be the festival? I don't know. Marie, thank you for the call. I'm sorry we're out of time, but interesting. Where do we go with that? You know, it's like, and how is this going to influence the presidential race, religion here?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, Catholicism worked against John Kennedy, but in some ways it worked for him, too. As I said, the Mormon Church is growing huge in the United States.
Lord knows the man's a fan, the only one who could ever reach me. Was the son of a preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me. Was the son of a preacher man, yes, he was.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, let's get off the topic of religion and good deeds and talk about... Actually, I think this is a good deed. The president yesterday recess-appointed several members to the National Labor Relations Board, but more famously, notoriously in the right-wing blogosphere and right-wing talk radio, appointed Richard Cordray as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the agency that will allow... the agency that will prevent loan shark organizations, but they wouldn't call themselves loan sharks, payday loan organizations and unregulated, otherwise unregulated banking institutions and organizations that interact with consumers, that will prevent them from ripping you off. Now, the Republicans are very upset about this. These industries, these pieces of the financial services industry, keep in mind the financial services industry produced about a third of all the profits in the United States last year. This is major, major stuff, a huge industry, major lobbyists, lots of money to buy lots of politicians. These industries do not want somebody looking out for the average person. And so the Republicans have been refusing to even consider the nomination of Richard Cordray for the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because they don't want consumers to be protected. In fact, they don't like the legislation, which they themselves passed, by the way, or participated in passing. Although, truth be told, it was passed back when the Democrats controlled a majority in the Senate and the House. But nonetheless, here it is. It's law. But the way the law was written, the organization, the agency can't operate until it has a head, until it has a director. And so they said, okay, we're going to prevent it from operating by not taking up your appointment and affirming him. Now, Article 1 of the Constitution deals with the legislative branch. Section 5, paragraph 4, kind of says, kind of establishes what has been thought of for the last 200 and some odd years as the three-day rule. Section 4 says, neither the House nor the Senate, during the session of Congress shall, without the consent of the other, adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than in which the two houses shall be sitting. So this has been interpreted over the years as to mean, you know, basically, if they're not showing up and doing business for more than 3 days, they're not really in session. Now, during the Bush administration, the Democrats did this. During the Obama administration, the Republicans are doing this. This is not new. And, in fact, back during the Teddy Roosevelt administration, 1906, 1907, it was being done by both, where they do what's called a pro forma session. One person shows up in the House or the Senate or both and says, I call this session to order. Anybody here? No? Okay, I cancel the session, or I close the session. And they say, okay, legally, we're still in session. Not I close the session, but, you know, I pause the session until tomorrow. And the president came along and said, no, this is a gimmick. You guys are not in session. You are on vacation and have been since Christmas. And you are not in session. It's been more than 3 days. And so I'm just going to go ahead and appoint this guy. Here's clip number 9.
President. So today we're taking another important step, one that will bring us closer to the economy that we need, an economy where everybody plays by the same rules. And to help us do that, I'm joined by somebody you might recognize, Richard Cordray. Today I'm appointing Richard as America's consumer watchdog.
So he just went ahead and did it. And he told Congress to take a leap. Now, Article 2, which deals with the executive branch of Congress, Article 2 of the Constitution, the second among equals, the executive branch, the presidency, and all the agencies that are created by Congress that the president is charged with making sure they operate, like the Consumer Protection, Financial Protection Bureau. It says the president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. And this is something the presidents have been doing forever. But the Republicans are hysterical and the conservatives, who want the banksters to be able to screw you and me and for us not to understand the fine print, not to know what's going on, these conservatives are hysterical. Here's GOP TV's Peter Johnson Jr., for example, talking about Obama's recess appointment.
This is for an imperial presidency. In my view, this is not a recess appointment. A recess appointment, it means that the president is not complying with Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution that gives the Senate the opportunity to confirm people.
Right.
And that can be done when the Senate is not in session. The Senate was in session, but the president said, well, no, that's a gimmick. I don't believe that you're really in session, so I'm going to do what I want because this needs to be done in terms of my people in the labor community and in terms of stopping predator lending and like that. So I'm going to do it. So in my view, this is a vigilante act of an imperial presidency.
A vigilante act of an imperial presidency. Is that bizarre? These guys, they're hysterical. It's going to be really interesting. Here's clip 10. This is why Obama said, you know, here's why we have to do this.
Now, I nominated Richard for this job last summer. So you may be wondering, why am I appointing him today? It would be a good question. For almost half a year, Republicans in the Senate have blocked Richard's confirmation. They refused to even give Richard an up or down vote.
There you go. So, anyhow, that's what's going on, and we'll come back to that as the day goes on. But I wanted to get it out there. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up several points about religion and politics. First of all, the Mormon Church. There's been Mo Udall. And he was Secretary of State, I believe, or the Interior under Kennedy.
Yep.
And then I think a relative of his, a nephew, is now a congressman from Mexico.
Yep.
And the Democrat. But the real reason I called is that I think we really need to make it clear that the framers of the Constitution, that the country is a secular state, and that for a very good reason there should be separation between church and state, and it really bothers me when religious leaders, suck up political people and then in turn suck up to them.
Yep.
A president was prayed over by evangelical leaders. I mean, we're making a president, and we should vote on the basis of whether he is the best person to do the job, not
yes.
that, or his religious affiliation.
And so I totally agree with you. And in fact, I think that a president who says that he is going to be motivated, led, or guided by his religion is frankly a danger to the country. I'm with Jefferson on John.
I mean, the country, Anabaptists, Quakers, escape religious persecution.
Yeah, John, I'm sorry, your phone is just breaking up terribly. I'm hearing every other word. But the point is, you know, what's really interesting, you read the letters of Jefferson and Madison. Madison was Jefferson's protege. Madison basically wrote the Constitution. You know, he kept all the notes of the Constitution. He studied constitutions for 5 years before he participated in the Constitutional Convention. And Jefferson was his mentor. And Madison felt that there should be a separation of church and state. In fact, when he became the fourth president of the United States, his first veto in office was to veto a law that gave churches in Washington, D.C. money to run poorhouses, because he said this should be secular. We should not be giving money to the churches. His greatest fear was that if government got involved with churches, it would corrupt the churches, because Madison was a good Christian or whatever, Presbyterian, Protestant, Congregationalist. He was one of them. But Madison was concerned about the church being corrupted by the government. Jefferson, on the other hand, was concerned about the government being corrupted by people who are religious getting into governmental position. And I think that's the question you have to ask. There was all this hysteria about, you know, Kennedy's a Catholic. Does that mean that we're going to have, you know, that the Pope is going to run the United States? And Kennedy just made that very clear. Politically, I don't answer the Pope. And I have not yet heard something like that from Mitt Romney about the Mormon Church, although perhaps he has said it. I don't know. Eric in Los Angeles. Eric, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to make a point that you keep hearing everything from these evangelicals saying they're going to eventually hold their nose and vote for Romney, when shouldn't they be holding their nose and voting for Obama since Obama is a Christian?
Well, and not only that, he is promoting policies that feed the hungry, that heal the sick, that give shelter to the shelterless. And back in Jesus' day, that would be clothing the naked, but now it's housing the homeless. I mean, he is pursuing those policies that define all the world's major religions, and for Christians, define Christianity. And so, yeah, I'm totally with you, Eric. If somebody wants to vote their religion, they should be voting that policy, or somebody even more progressive than that, more progressive than Obama.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check in with the Talk Radio News Service after this. Find out what's going on in the world. 45 minutes past the hour.
All the doors that I had to close, all the things I knew but I didn't know. Thank God for all of me.
Fair and only, slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Just a quick heads up, by the way. There's been a lot of questions about what's going on in Iceland. Iceland has had two referendums where they've said to the banksters, no and hell no. And so that's a really curious situation. And then there's a lot of questions about what happened in Sweden. Back in 97, I believe it was, Sweden had their banks crash, and so they nationalized them, and they said, and they fired all the banksters, and they let them go down and took them over. And how does Sweden run? How does that country operate? How does that work? And what's life like there? So next Tuesday, I believe it is, we will be doing this show live. Monday? Thank you, Louise. Next Monday, we will be doing this show live from Iceland. And next Thursday, is that right, Louise? Next Thursday, we will be doing this show live from Sweden. Just an FYI. Should be a lot of fun. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment, on the line with us. Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Well, today the president at the Pentagon, the very first time in history that a president has held a news conference at the Pentagon, and very unusually his appearance in the Pentagon briefing room with Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, both there, outlined a broad new military strategy for the United States, one that refocuses the armed forces on threats in Asia and the Pacific, which also continues a strong presence in the Middle East. But it also says that, look, the American forces are not going to stay large enough to conduct really large-scale counterinsurgency campaigns like those in Iraq and Afghanistan two at a time, basically. Mm-hmm. We can conduct one large war. We can conduct a lot of other things at the same time, but it's a different time. But he also said very, very clearly, look, we have ended our war in Iraq. We've decimated al-Qaeda's leadership. He did a long laundry list. He said the United States of America is the greatest force for freedom and security that the world has ever known. Mm-hmm. He talked about the best-trained, best-led, best-equipped military in history. And as commander-in-chief, I'm going to keep it that way. And I mention that because I think you may hear quite a lot of hits from the Republican candidates about how he does not possibly believe those things. Right. But he also said that we have to renew our economic strength at home, which is the foundation of our strength around the world, and that it's important to have a balance. And in that connection, he quoted President Eisenhower as saying that there needs to be a balance.
That's remarkable. And in a way, what he's doing is he's taking what is always one of the major applause lines in the Republican debates, when Ron Paul says we need to get out of these foreign countries and we don't need to be spending all this money on our military. We should be building things at home instead, and doing that. And that's got to be something that's, you know, I realize all the Republicans and Fox News, of course, is just going to go hysterical on this. And you've got a lot of defense contractors in this town who, you know, living in 35-bedroom mansions with 15 servants living in the servants' quarters next door, who are going to be hysterical about this, although probably most of them are going to continue to do just fine, thank you very much. But,
well, and certainly there are civilians who support the military, and there are military families who are concerned about retirement benefits and health benefits, so that there are possible changes to them that, in this town, that people are interested in and concerned about.
And is he, so is he going to do this in a way that will not hurt those people?
Well, they say that they're going to do any changes over time so that any changes will have minimal impact. But yes, there are going to be changes. Yes, indeed, there are going to be changes. Where there are not going to be changes, areas of Pentagon spending that will be protected. There won't be an advocate for cuts in financing for defense and offense in cyberspace, special ops forces, or for broad areas of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Right. They will all stay the same.
So we're getting a smarter military rather than a beefier one. But, I mean,
right.
you've got in Afghanistan now, you've got people who are being basically forced into a second, third, fourth tour of duty, or we're offering huge re-sign incentives, bonuses. It seems to me like having some of those people's, saying to some of those people, okay, you don't have to go back there anymore. And if you don't want to stay in the military anymore, we're not going to force you to, like they basically were before, that's not decimating our military.
That is, I think, the point that he's making. He also made the point, and I think he made this point quite deliberately, that the defense budget has grown at an extraordinary pace since 9/11. And he says it will slow over the next 10 years, but it will still grow. And he said, in fact, the defense budget will still be larger than it was towards the end of the Bush administration.
Right, which is his way of saying, don't try to say on the campaign trail that I cut defense.
Back off is what I think exactly what he's saying, yes.
Yeah, very interesting. What else is going on?
Strong economic numbers released today. This is very interesting. This is the day before the unemployment rate and the jobs numbers in December will be released tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Private sector hiring surged in December to the highest level in 10 years, according to the payrolls report released today by ADP Employment Services. Companies added 325,000 workers last month, dramatically surpassing the consensus of payrolls increasing by 175,000. Now, of course, this was December, so there could be a market fluctuation for holiday hiring. But Wall Street analysts are also saying, well, the shock from the tsunami and the Arab Spring, these things are fading now. So you're starting to see the recovery as it would have been if those things had not happened.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting because it seems to me like the recovery, in order for there to be a real recovery, like back, a multi-decade recovery, we need to be rebuilding manufacturing in this country and making things that we're just maybe moving into another bubble, but. Well, that's a whole other conversation. Anyway, other news in the world?
Well, as you know, there's been a great deal of news about Iran. You've got the EU going to clamp down on sales of Iran oil. Also, Iran intensifying efforts to influence policy in Afghanistan. And then a story out today about how it's clamping down heavily on web users and with draconian new rules on cyber cafes and preparations to launch a national internet possibly going off the global grid.
Interesting. Iran.
Iran.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Germany explodes the Republican myth. This is incredible when you think about this. Germany just announced this week that their unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in 20 years. And 20 years ago, they were doing pretty good. They also... This is going to make your head explode. They also announced that not only do they make a lot of things there, like they make twice as many cars. But Germany's a country of, as I recall, 54 million or thereabouts people. We have 300 and change million. So it's smaller than us. And they made last year 5.5 million cars. We made 2.7 million. And not just cars. I mean, they make precision equipment, medical machinery, precision tools, the list goes on and on. But guess what the average auto worker in Germany makes? Now, in the United States, the average auto worker makes $33.77 an hour. That includes the benefits. and at GM, Chrysler, and whatnot, the new hires are coming in at $14 an hour. That's the United States. So we've seen, since Reagan came into office, the average wage of the average U.S. auto worker dropping from what would be in today's dollars around $40, $45, $50 an hour down to $14 an hour at entry level. 30 years of Reaganomics and insane free trade policies. Germany, which protects its domestic industries, which requires its large corporations to have half of their board of directors made up of representatives of labor, which has a system called workers' councils, where the workers actually make all the major decisions about the workplace, how things happen on the factory floor. Germany, the average hourly salary with benefits in Germany is $67.14. And on top of that, those German workers have free health care. And their kids have free education all the way through college, more or less free. It's amazing. One of, and by the way, they have the right to strike in Germany, but they almost never do. Why? Because they run the factory floor. So you'd say, now the conservatives would look at this and say, wow, Germany must be having horrible problems. They must just be falling off the edge of the earth. They pay $67 an hour, and the workers run the factories. Their CEOs must be hysterical. No, their CEOs are doing just fine, thank you very much. Their stockholders are doing just fine. In fact, their companies are making billions with a B. Last year, Volkswagen, BMW, Audi, all three of the major German car manufacturers all reported profits in the billions. That's profits, that's the leftover money after everybody's been paid, after the CEOs have been compensated, and they're well compensated, not hundreds or thousands of times better than the average worker, but dozens of times. But they're very well compensated. They're making good money. Karl Mund is an executive with IG Metall, which is the largest union that represents workers in Germany. And he said First of all, he said that because of these works councils, he said, you don't always wear your management pin or your union pin. In other words, we're working together here. What an amazing idea. An economy where people collaborate. And then on top of that, he said, this goes against all the mainstream wisdom of the neoliberals. Now, Germany, Europe, they refer to what we here call Republicans or conservatives. They call them neoliberals. Liberalism in Europe means being in favor of business being able to do whatever it wants, unrestrained business. Now, here in the United States, liberalism means having a social safety net and providing people with bootstraps so they can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and providing, you know, a better education system and a free education system and a better healthcare system and a free health. But they already have all that stuff in Germany. So when they say liberal, they mean letting government, having smaller government. That's neoliberalism. So he says the fact that their German companies are making billions in profits, and the average worker in Germany, which means that there's some making more than this, the average, and some making less, but the average auto worker in Germany makes $67.14 an hour. He said, this goes against all mainstream wisdom of the neoliberals, what we would call the conservatives. We have strong unions. We have strong social security systems. We have high wages. So, says Karl Mund, if I believed what the neoliberals are arguing, that is the conservatives, our American conservatives, we would have to be bankrupt. But apparently this is not the case. Despite high wages, despite our possibility to influence companies, and the hour he's talking about is the union, he's the president of the largest auto workers union, the economy is working well in Germany. As I mentioned, we're gonna do our show next next Friday from Sweden, we will, or next Thursday from Sweden, Thursday or Friday, whatever, and Monday from Iceland, and we will be, I'm really looking forward to finding out what's going on in these countries from the horse's mouth. We have some of the local politicians, local pundits, local conservatives and liberals using our terms to be on the program to find out what's going on in these countries. What is going on? How is it that they work? Now, meanwhile, Mitt Romney was hit with an Occupy Wall Street question. His first, he had his, you know, Mitt Romney, the guy who in 1991 took a $10 million government bailout to keep Bain Financial from failing. The guy who said that he would have let General Motors fail. Mitt Romney held a town hall yesterday with John McCain, which kind of went over like a lead balloon. And here's clip one. This is his first question.
I'm Mark from Occupy Boston, and I'm from Occupy New Hampshire. Would you refine your earlier statement from corporations are people to corporations are abusive people?
Now let's get the facts, all right? There are two places it can go. Hold on. It's my turn.
Okay, Mitt. And then he goes off. Mitt goes off on one of his rants. You know, it's corporations, they're people, my friend, but they're made up of people, and quack, quack, quack. It's nonsense. Corporations are artificial entities. Corporations are artifices. Corporations are creations of the state. We allow corporations to come into being. It's very simple. And Rick Perry is continuing. He went back to Texas, and he's got some money in his pocket. Clip number four, here's Rick Perry.
This wasn't a hard decision. This was one of those where, you know, you take a look. You didn't do as well in Iowa as you wanted to, but this is a quirky place and a quirky process.
Yeah, let's just slap down those Iowa voters. Right, Rick. Good idea. I think the folks in New Hampshire are thinking, gee, I wonder if he's going to think that we're quirky, too. And Rick Santorum, this is clip number seven, actually, a short piece from Newt's new ad going, let's play Santorum first, clip number six.
Oh, the certain candidate is the most electable. What would give you that impression? When has that candidate ever run as a conservative and gotten any votes? Never. So why would you assume that he's the most electable? Is it because he raises the most money?
Yeah, it is actually. The he that Santorum is talking about, of course, is Mitt Romney. And yeah, he's worth $400 million, and he's got billionaires behind him, including Wall Street. So, you know, he's pretty much going to be the Republican nominee. 15 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Jamie Weinstein is calling in from New Hampshire, conservative commentator. He's hanging out with Rick Santorum today. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television via Free Speech TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide. Pleased to have you with us, and pleased to have you, Jamie Weinstein, with us with the Daily Caller, senior editor with the Daily Caller. TheDailyCaller.com is the website for that conservative news and commentary site. Jamie.
Good to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. You are in New Hampshire, I understand.
Yes, that's right. I am. I've been in New Hampshire since the day of the Iowa caucus.
So as a are you mostly wearing your reporter hat or mostly wearing your conservative commentator hat?
All my articles I've written so far in New Hampshire have been just reporting on what I've seen, but I might break out a column sometime in the near future. But so far, been reporting.
Okay. Well, you can take your choice of which you'd like to do with us today in the 5 minutes we have here.
Sure.
I'm curious what your take is on what's going on in New Hampshire now that It looks like Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, that Newt Gingrich is basically doing the same thing. It looks like to me he's doing the same thing that he did when Bill Clinton sent him to the back of the plane and he threw a tantrum and shut down the government. Now he's going to throw a tantrum and shut down Mitt Romney.
Well, it was interesting. Newt Gingrich had the first campaign event after the Iowa caucus. So on Wednesday morning, I went to go see Newt Gingrich at a Holiday Inn in Concord, Massachusetts. And he had two events there. One was the general event, and then he had a media availability. And it basically was a tale of two Newts. During the general event, to a packed room, actually as many press as there were New Hampshireites, but it was a packed room nonetheless. He was, professorial, discussing American exceptionalism, what it means to be American, and so on and so forth. Very upbeat, very positive, no negativity whatsoever. But then you go over to the press room, where the press gathered to hear Newt in the adjacent room, and immediately he went after Mitt Romney as being a Massachusetts moderate compared to what he called himself a Reagan conservative, and he looked like he was geared to go. No more Mr. Nice Newt in Massachusetts. So he seems ready to go after Mitt Romney, who he thinks wronged him in Iowa through his super PACs, which Mitt Romney technically has nothing to do with. But they went after Newt Gingrich there. So Newt is ready to certainly go after Mitt Romney here in New Hampshire.
So taking, if I may ask, a commentary question or an observation, I don't know what you call this, but whatever, do you think that Newt thinks that he has a snowball's chance in Hades in winning and is seriously going for the victory, or is he just continuing the book tour and trying to sell more books and movies, or is he on a vendetta to take down Romney no matter what, just because he's angry?
But you would think that, I don't know the answer to that, but I think if he wanted to take down Romney no matter what, he would consider dropping out of the race and uniting behind Rick Santorum or someone else Rick Santorum's surging right now, and trying to consolidate the anti-Romney vote behind one candidate.
Right.
So I'm not sure that that's what he's doing. He did say that he doesn't expect to win New Hampshire, which I think disappointed some of his staff who's been in the state fighting for him, and he might be looking towards South Carolina, where the last poll I saw was a while ago, mid-December, when Newt was in the lead, his rise, and he was leading in South Carolina. But I don't know if that's still the case now that he's dropped substantially.
We had Pastor Jeffers on the program earlier, the fellow who endorsed Rick Perry, and Romney had explicitly asked Perry to disavow this fellow because he says that Mormonism is a cult, and Perry said no, he's not going to disavow him.
Right.
And the pastor is still speaking now. He and I were on Bill Maher together some time ago, and he was on our show today, and he's still singing that song. And basically, Mitt Romney only got 8% of the evangelical vote in Iowa. Rick Santorum got 56% of the evangelical vote. Rick Santorum is Catholic, although Mitt Romney has converted to Newt Gingrich has converted to Catholicism, although a lot of people doubt his conversion to anything after three wives. But he's theoretically a Catholic. And 60% of the population in New Hampshire, I used to live there, and Louise and I lived in New Hampshire for 5 years. 60% of the population of New Hampshire is Catholic. But I don't think that they're as passionate about their Catholicism as the fundamentalist evangelicals are about their evangelicalism, or however you say it, in Iowa. Is religion going to play a role in this thing? Could that have something to do with the Santorum surge, the fact that he's a Catholic and he's campaigning in a state that's 60% Catholic?
Maybe. I thought the Mormonism might be a problem in 2008. I see it as less of a problem now. But I've been to a rally, Santorum's first rally in the state since the Iowa caucuses last night, and I just returned from two events he just had. And you know what? He's inspiring people, I think, through detail. His detail in his speeches are pretty remarkable, and the answer to his questions, to people's questions. He you might call it professorial, almost the way like Newt is, without the consternation or the kind of looking down upon the questioner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people appeal to that. I don't know what his ceiling here is in the state or if he can win. But if he comes in third and Ron Paul's second and Mitt Romney's first in the state, that's a huge win for him.
Do you really think, though, that Americans would vote for anybody who thinks that birth control should be made illegal?
He does not. I don't know if Rick Santorum actually believes that, or he's certainly not campaigning on that.
Well, he said that three or four days ago in an interview that if a state wants to do that's a state's rights issue, which completely contradicts the 1965 Supreme Court decision.
Yeah.
So, well, maybe he was pitching states' rights rather than.
He might be pitching that. He's not campaigning on it. He looks somewhat popular right now.
Very interesting. Jamie Weinstein, senior editor of the Daily Caller. You can read his work over at it's thedailycaller.com or dailycaller.com, Jamie?
Dailycaller.com.
Dailycaller.com. My apologies. Dailycaller.com. Jamie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Always great.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As I was saying when I was so rudely interrupted, 27 minutes past the hour. Back with the good, the bad, the insanely ugly, your thoughts and mine. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very septophobically ugly, the good. Nancy Pelosi. As a result of the Defense of Marriage Act, same-sex couples are not recognized by the federal government and thus could be subject to deportation if one of the people in the relationship is not an American citizen. That's what happened to a San Francisco couple, Bradford Wells and Anthony Mac, who's an Australian citizen, has lived in the United States for 20 years, has no criminal history, and is the primary caregiver to his husband since they were married back in 2004. But none of that mattered as Mac was put up to be deported to Australia. That's when Pelosi stepped in on behalf of her constituents and staved off deportation. Thanks to her work, Immigration Services has granted Mac a 2-year deferment on deportation. Well done. Now let's get to work repealing the discriminatory Defense of Marriage Act altogether. The bad. Newt Gingrich, serial adulterer and campaign huckster, Newt, prides himself on his knowledge of history. At a town hall meeting in New Hampshire yesterday, Newt used his so-called knowledge of the Founding Fathers to go after marijuana. I think Jefferson and George Washington would strongly discourage you from growing marijuana, and their tactics to stop you would be more violent than they would be today, said the Newtster. Right. The Founding Fathers hated growing marijuana, except for the fact that both Washington and Jefferson grew marijuana, or hemp plants, on their plantations. Nice try, Newt. And the very, very ugly Herman Cain. Disgraced fake Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain is back. He appeared on GOP TV last night with Sean Hannity to make a big announcement. He wasn't endorsing anyone. He's not getting back in the race. He's starting a bus tour to con more people into giving him money. He says, I'm calling it Cain's Solutions Revolution. He said the point of the bus tour is to keep 999 alive. In reality, the point of the bus tour is to continue what he was doing with his presidential bid, get his name out there for higher speaking fees and more book sales. And since pretending to care about America by driving a bus around the nation has worked so well for Sarah Palin, Herman Cain is going to give it a try. So please, don't give him any money. It's very, very ugly. That's incredible. That's really incredible. This is from George Washington's diary. Newt Gingrich said the Founding Fathers would have come after you violently if you grew hemp, right? If you grew pot. George Washington's diary, August 7th, 1765, began to separate the male from the female hemp plants a bit too late. It's just incredible. Washington tried to grow hemp, was not successful at it. Jefferson tried to grow hemp, was not so successful at it. Now, here's a quote that was passed along. I don't think this is a genuine quote. Some of my finest hours have been spent sitting on my back veranda smoking hemp and observing as far as my eye can see. I don't believe it. But if it's true, somebody let me know. If Jefferson had ever made any reference to smoking hemp, I think everybody would know it and be all over the place. But he did grow it. And they tried to export it, and it just wasn't that good a quality. I think that, hemp grows better in the more, in the plains states. Grow it in Iowa, grow it in Indiana, grow it in Michigan, grow it in Montana, grow it in the Dakotas or wherever. I mean, that's, you know, seems to do better in those kind of climates. But Newt saying, no. I mean, this is, again, Ron Paul. We should legalize pot and all other drugs. Yeah, of course. Portugal did that, and look at what happened. Their heroin addiction rate went down. Their organized crime syndicates were broken up. I mean, it's been a decade since Portugal legalized all drugs or decriminalized them. They didn't legalize them fully, but they decriminalized. So you can't walk into a 7-Eleven and say, hey, I'll have some heroin. You know, they didn't legalize them, but they decriminalized. They don't put people in jail for it anymore. And they used that money to fund treatment centers. And so the addiction rates have gone down. Nobody wants to be addicted to a drug. It's a crummy, lousy way to live and all that kind of stuff. So, anyhow, Charles in Reagan, Tennessee. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I was curious if speech is money and if corporations are people, why isn't Mitt Romney charged for murder and the Koch brothers charged for slander?
A good rhetorical question, Charles. There's a lot of them. If corporations are people, then when they buy other corporations, why aren't they charged with, you know, felony slavery?
Murder. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, or if Romney kills off a company to be more profitable, why? Yeah, good point. Charles, thank you very much, and well said. Carol in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I watched the president's speech today about changing the strategy for our military.
Right, and you live in a very military town.
Oh, I do. Well, actually, Charlottesville's not that military.
Oh, okay.
We do have some installations outside of Charlottesville.
Oh, you're right. Charlottesville is near Monticello, right?
Oh, Monticello is inside Charlottesville.
Yeah, okay. Louise and I were there a couple of weekends ago. I'm sorry. I was thinking of someplace else.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, but anyway, this president said that the new strategy was going to be to use the FBI, the CIA, and forces for incursions rather than these huge military wars. And it dawned on me what he was doing was thinking of how they got Osama bin Laden.
Yeah,
because that's exactly what they did. They used the FBI, who had fingered the courier. They used the CIA to track the courier, and then they knew exactly where bin Laden was.
Right, and then they
now,
sent in
a book,
special forces.
A book called Black Banners by Ali Soufan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read it.
No, I
hadn't. You should read it because it outlines exactly how the FBI fingered this courier, what the CIA did to track him, and then Obama had two choices. He could either use B-2 bombers and bomb that compound, or he could send in the special forces. And he sent in the special forces.
Right.
So I think this gave him the template for what he wants to do with our military.
Yeah. It raises a larger question or issue too, Carol, and that is to put it in the abstract for a moment. Why is Al Qaeda not plotting against Canada? Why are they not plotting against Mexico? And the reason might be that those countries are not using fleets to protect Saudi Arabia, you know, or they're not using fleets to protect the oil pipelines, or they're not in bed with all the Arab dictatorships in the Middle East, or they're not fanning the flames of the Arab of the Israeli Arab conflict, and on it goes. And I'm, you know, in this regard, I'm with Ron Paul on this. We need to rethink our entire foreign policy and military policy because there's, you know, and ask ourselves, you know, why are these people coming after us? Let's stop doing that.
Well, in Ali Soufan's book, Ali Soufan was the FBI agent who initially interrogated KFM and Zubaydah and a lot of these people. And he agrees with you.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what the Al Qaeda people say.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's obvious.
Yeah.
It's obvious.
Yeah, no, it's bin Laden himself back in 98,
yeah.
You know, the New York Times publisher, said that his two complaints were that we had a military base in Saudi Arabia, which was a result of Bush the Elder having his war when he threw what's his name out of Kuwait Saddam Hussein, when he threw Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And that military base was still there, the Prince Sultan Air Force Base, and that the men were watching pornography and drinking alcohol, and the women were driving and running around with their elbows uncovered. And that was sacrilegious, number one. And number two, that we were buying oil from his country for less than $100 a barrel, which is what he thought was a fair price in the open market. And therefore, we were ripping off the country, and we were supporting an arrogant dictatorship in the process, a dictatorship which, by the way, had deported Osama bin Laden when he tried to invade Iraq himself with a ragtag army from inside Saudi Arabia. They grabbed him, deported him, and dumped him in Somalia and said, that's it, you're no longer a Saudi. And that's when he went kind of nuts. And so it's like, you know, our policies are coming back to, and these are policies that go back to the 20s, you know, they go back to the end of World War One. Our policies are biting us in the butt, and we need to stop doing them. Carol, thanks for pointing that out, and thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Lee in Reed Point, Montana. Hey, Lee, what's on your mind?
Hey, good show, Tom.
Thank you.
That feller that called in about the CO2 wells down in New Mexico and stuff.
Yeah.
They're not CO2 wells. What they are is CO2 injection wells. What they do is inject CO2 on the perimeter of the oil field, an exhausted oil field, and they push the oil out with it.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. So we manufacture CO2, don't we? I mean, isn't there?
Yeah, we refine it, you know, from the refineries and different companies that in the business for CO2.
Yeah.
For soda pops or whatever.
Right.
But what they do is they go into an old exhausted oil field and they inject it on the perimeter, the outside perimeter.
I see.
And push what little dribbles of oil is left out to the wellhead.
Right. And that makes sense. And that's not quite fracking. It's quite different from fracking.
No, fracking they've been doing for years. That's an old thing. But down there, the fracking is done under a real deep surfaces where they got in trouble in Colorado is it was pretty shallow, the oil and gas.
Yeah. And in Ohio, they just had the earthquakes and things. Lee, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And we will, I'm sure, be learning more about this subject as time goes on. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
PR guy in our chat room says around 1815, Jefferson received the first U.S. patent for his hemp breaking machine, which reportedly did the work of 10 men. Whoa.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 10 minutes before the hour, and Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today? Bob? You know, I think I'm wondering, Jacob, if we've got something flaky going on with our phone system. Although most of the other calls seem to be coming through just fine. I'm putting that one on hold on line 10. You can check it out. Paul. Dean in Los Angeles. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Tom, good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Just a brief thing I wanted to mention about hemp. I'm actually really hoping hemp becomes an issue this election cycle.
It won't, because neither party is willing to talk about it.
Right. I thought one good anecdote to mention is, by the way, is Gingrich aware that our Constitution is written on hemp?
Right, although actually the early drafts of the Constitution were written on hemp paper. The actual Constitution itself is written on vellum, which is sheepskin, the ones that got printed and got passed out, a lot of paper back then, and particularly the fine paper was hemp paper. So yeah, there certainly were some copies of it, but not the official copies. The official copies were done on vellum. But point made.
It'd be rather useful if at least legislators could look at maybe differentiating between hemp and marijuana, because, of course, the classification of marijuana as a drug was the criminalization of hemp was started back in the mid-1800s, wasn't it?
No, it was the 19-teens, as I recall, that the whole reefer madness thing started, and this was being, as other callers have noted, was being promoted by Rockefeller in the background, the oil interests, the big oil interests because hemp was a great source of oil. And then the racists jumped on the bandwagon because there were all these awful stereotypes and the jazz scene and whatnot. And then there's also an argument that the alcohol beverage industry and the tobacco industry were in on it. It was basically, you know, hemp was not a big profitable industry, and so, you know, it didn't have defenders, and marijuana certainly didn't. And I think the whole war on drugs that you can track back to that Reefer Madness time. Oh, and Harry Anslinger was in the process of trying to build an empire over at the Drug Enforcement Administration, which was brought into being by these laws. And so you had this kind of perfect storm of people with unique self-interests all coming together on an issue. Dean, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Sean in Seattle. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, what's up, Tom? I wish we could get free speech, RT, Al Jazeera up here, but Comcast, or as I call it, the Beast.
Yeah. But, hey, you got AM 1090, which is one of the great talk stations in the country that you're listening to us on right now. So that's, you know, let us be glad for our blessings. So what's up, Sean?
I wanted to call when you were talking about Germany and how, you know, effective their economy is with their unions. I was thinking an analogy that dispels trickle-down economics is that when you're trying to grow a plant or a crop, you get the nutrients in the water to the roots, the bottom, and then you're successful. You try to just feed the top with a dropper or something, it's not going to go anywhere.
Right. Oh, that's a good point. So trickle-down economics doesn't work because it's like trying to feed the top of a plant rather than the roots. That excellent analogy, Sean. Thank you very much for that. Mike in Kelso, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's up?
My deal is on Obama's press conference.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, all Obama is doing with his mean and meaning of the military is carrying on a program of Bush and Clinton and Bush began, and people don't realize the real true military structure as it is today compared to what we saw the Korean War, whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah, we are.
The chief of staff is no more than an administrative group. They actually have less command value than any general who runs any of our central commands or African commands or anything in theater.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm with you, Mike. And also, basically, now we have a military designed for empire, and we didn't have that until after World War One, arguably, and certainly after World War Two. Thanks a lot for the call. And that's what, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was concerned about. Larry in Silver Springs, Nevada. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I, in the mid-70s, was in D.C. and checked out the National Archives there.
Mm-hmm.
And down in the Washington room, they had a letter that was written by him to his buddy, Thomas Jefferson, telling him that he had tried hemp, smoking it, and thought it was great, and suggested that he try it.
You're kidding.
No, it should still be there unless, you know, the powers that be got rid of it.
Well, Louise and I got our official library cards at the National Archives. You've got to fill out a whole application, get your picture taken and stuff. And as researchers, Louise and I are now officially researchers at the National Archives, so we'll have to get down there and check that out one of these days. I can get some time. Thank you very much, Larry, for that call. I appreciate it. Ron from Cook Hill, Oregon. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Well, I just got done with Cheney's book that was pre-waterboard that we talked about some time ago. Soggy read. But I wanted to comment about the hemp.
Yeah.
The DuPont family and Randolph Hearst were big into the making hemp illegal. Hearst had bought large tracts of second growth forests in California to be used for yellow paper for his journalism.
Right.
And DuPont had come up with the dioxin bleaching process whereby they could turn the paper white, plus DuPont had Orlon, nylon, and all the synthetic
fibers. So they wanted to get rid of hemp as a competitor, as a competing fiber.
The decoordinator had come into being, which was the same as the cotton gin was to cotton. The decoordinator was to
hemp, to fibrous, hemp. Fibrous things. Very interesting. Ron, thank you for that little bit of history. I'm telling you, we have the smartest listeners on earth. Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And Anything Goes Friday, don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Not enough to just vote. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.